This is Maria Rosaris presenting New Voices, a program which interviews brand new writers from all walks of life, deep in the throes of their writing projects. I will interview them, get them to read a sample of their work, then get a total stranger to critique them. Welcome to episode 7 of New Voices, which features a feast for the senses. Swaga Mahapatra, Indian-born, a software developer, delivers lilting, rolling chasms of poetry and crime, and deftly blending the tones of epic Indian sagas into detective stories. Yes, you heard me right. And who better to critique such a complex offering than the eminent Australian academic and literacy luminary, Dr. Bill Cope? The science of language is his specialty. The list of his publications are as long as my arm. His career is equally illustrious, and currently he's a professor at the University of Illinois, teaching PhD students globally on innovative platforms. His clarity about how Swaga's indie English fits into a global trend is brilliant info for the word nerds. He reminds us that some of the greatest English novelists of our times come from India. Think Arundhati Roy, Vikram Seth, Salman Rushdie. And he apprises me of the fact that English is now considered a polyphonic language, with slightly different dialects being practiced all around the world. He asserts, all fiction writing is like the detective stories that Swaga loves so much. The craft is about deceiving the reader, and the success of any writing is how much you can mess with a reader's mind. And just to balance out this heady academic liquor, we have two local pundits who are giving their views. Actor Caroline George and 2RPH's very own technical manager, Peter Worthington. Both these critiquers have a very fine ear. They know all about the value of words, its impact on the ear and the emotions. Listen to their oral critique and land it side by side with Dr. Bill Cope's deliciously analytical point of view. I'm very pleased to be offering you this extraordinary episode. Sit back and enjoy. Oh, and do excuse the Zoom echo. It's COVID. Swaga, welcome to New Voices.
Thank you, Maya, for inviting me.
How long have you been in the writers' group now? Not that long.
It feels like I was always there. But
and that's exactly how we felt. How did you come to writing? Because what's your day job? What is it that you're actually trained to do?
I am a software developer.
You're a software developer.
Yeah.
But you're only young, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're in the 30s. Early 30s?
30 plus.
You know, the first time that you came to our group, wrote this beautiful poem. But then basically weaves a whole mystery thriller around the poem.
Correct.
The writing that you do write is quite lyrical. Yeah. So why is your mind going to murder mystery?
Yeah, I think I've always been fascinated by mind, psychology.
Yeah.
I realized that the feeling and the attraction that I have towards thrillers, crime thrillers, psychological thrillers.
Is it the excitement?
Yeah, it's the excitement.
Is it the problem solving? Is it the character development? Is it
Everything. Whenever I'm watching any mystery, I from the start till the end, I just want to know who is the one. I think it started when I was a child. We used to hear stories about my mythology.
So mythic stories.
I think it's something which we don't believe, but it still exists. Epics.
Ah, yes, those Indian epics.
Like it's Mahabharata. It's one of classic epics written.
Mahabharata.
Yeah. There are many instances in it where we cannot explain things, why it happened. Mm. It keeps on asking questions to us that, okay, do you think it would have ended in this way? But it doesn't.
There's intrigue that's built into those epic sagas.
Yeah.
Is pretty similar to a detective murder mystery thriller.
Yeah, that's
what do your friends and partner think about you writing?
They have been extremely supportive. Do all the torture to my husband that, okay, please help me do something. And he's super supportive. I think you need someone like that.
Yeah.
Apart from that, I have my cousin who is a doctor. So I have to do a little bit of research on what happens. Because obviously when there is a crime scene, then
you check the forensics.
Yeah, I check all the forensics with her.
So that's useful. What are your ambitions as far as writing?
I just want to write lots and lots and lots of books and get a lot of money out of
right,
it.
Right,
great. I didn't mean that, just came out of it.
Let's hear a little bit more of your writing. So I think we're going to go to the second poem.
Yeah, I called it a masterpiece because this is my favorite. I just love it.
It's your masterpiece.
Yeah, it's my masterpiece.
Yeah, you know what? People who are listeners, I look at Swaga and she is so sweet.
Yep.
So this is a very surprising side of you, Swaga, that I'm discovering.
Yeah, I hope everyone likes it.
Okay, let's hear the masterpiece.
Rendezvous. It wasn't, and yet she was there. Leaning on the bridge, she kept to stare into the sky. But the sky never changed. Winds kept whispering into her ears, and yet the river was unchanged. Still she stood in the cold. Alone she was in the crowd. Misty-eyed, every sight got blurred. There she was, watching into that long cloud. Who could match the rhythm, she thought? Who could trace her footsteps, she bought? If only I could read her mind, soft and sweet, it would be undefined. If only I could write about it, happy and loud it would be, and who wouldn't love it? She looked at me and she smiled. Red were her cheeks and eyes drowned in tears. On a glance, I could see her years of life. Young she was, and now I had lived her life. She looked at me and she smiled. Only before I could smile back. Only before I could have a second sight. Minutes before I could extend my walk. Seconds before I could pat on her back. Arrives the time when this tail gets thumped. She took away that smile. And yes, she jumped.
Oh, wow. That is so beautiful.
Thank you. It's just a scene which I wanted to create.
And there's something about the intimacy between the watcher and the watched.
This
is where your story starts.
Yeah, true. This is where it starts.
Yeah.
It feels like it is suicide, but it's actually not a suicide.
Yeah.
So I have this
idea. You shouldn't
idea.
Tell us too much.
Okay.
Sorry.
I was going to say, you know, thank you for stopping me. It's a clue. Somebody has seen her, and that's the clue to find out it.
And do you already have it worked out in your mind?
Yeah.
Because it's a little bit like an artist. You know how an artist does a charcoal sketch? Because you were telling me that you're from a part of India
In the eastern part. I'm basically born and brought up in Bhubaneswar, which is the capital city of Odisha.
Yeah.
And then I came to Mumbai for work because I got posted over there. And then I came to Melbourne for 6 months in 2015. Yeah. And then I came to Sydney.
And you must miss your family.
Yeah. It will be 3 years since we visited India.
Yeah.
So we're so much excited to just go around and...
Still in all, not having family close by means that you can get a lot of writing done.
Yeah. That's true. And I always write after 12 o'clock midnight because that's when I get some free time and silence. Yeah. I sit on my desk. I have this desk set up and I have this big glass window. From there, I can see the parking lot. I see people just come, they drive through. They don't know I'm watching them.
Yeah.
But I do watch them.
Oh, you watch everything, don't you?
Yeah, I watch everything.
So I'm wondering if we can have the frying fish one.
Yeah, sure.
Story, which is a snippet of life, basically your relationship with your husband. Very sweet. Does he mind being the subject?
I think he does not know yet.
And
this is something that actually happened. So it's little things. It's called the lemon incident. The water rushed through my hands, reaching to the fish as I cleaned and already plated it in my mind. Hot, fried, crispy fish, along with salt and crushed green chili. Always been a fan of it. "Do we have lemons for the water rice?" my husband asked. "They are there somewhere. Where exactly, I don't know. Let me find it for you." I heard the door slammed just as I said, "Let me find it for you." Frying the fish is something which I was always in love with. The pungent smell of the mustard oil made the fish crispy, sending signals to my heart to eat one. Wait, let it fry. Eager and anxious, I took one piece only to hold. I couldn't eat it. Never had eaten alone on Sundays. "Oh, I could eat it and he will never know, but I will know." I stand there watching the hot, mouth-watering fish become warm from hot. And what was next? Cold? I stand there and I stand there. The door slammed again and the bearded man had returned. All my wit was poured on my face, pulling it down with anger. "You are not late," I said. "Oh, you never have been late. Always in time, perfect to eat my hot fried fish, which are cold as ice now. I have never eaten hot fish after marrying you. I've always handled you, taken care of you. Whom should I ask to take care of me? Oh, I've never eaten hot fish after marrying you." He was silent. "Are you going to say something?" I went to 3 different stores to bring lemons. I could not find them anywhere. "Yeah, the lemons. We could have eaten without it," I said. "You could have eaten without me," he said. "That's the issue. I never have and I never will." The next day, while rearranging my stacked food in the refrigerator, my eyes fell upon this little space which seemed, as I pulled it out, as one bright yellow lemon. Staring at me, it said, "Oh, now you know what's love, isn't it?"
Such a vivid, lovely piece, Swaga. But tell me, as a writer, what will be your biggest challenge?
The biggest challenge for me, as you also know, is, I think in a different way, the way I write stories, sentence formation, it comes in a way which I understand.
Mm.
But I think when I present it to people, there is a gap.
Developed. So is it a translation?
Yeah.
You're thinking in one language and you're translating
it.
Yes,
correct.
Yeah, yeah. Correct. Were you educated in English?
Yeah. My mother tongue is not English. I was taught in English, but I realized that my English, that what I say and what I write about, is a little bit different from what people here understand.
Mm. You know, in the writers group, what we value is that you do have that original way of expressing yourself.
Yeah.
Sometimes it tips over.
Yeah.
We don't want you to lose it. So that's why we don't pick it up every time.
Yeah.
How about a final poem?
The Leo versus Virgo.
Yes.
Leo versus Virgo. This is something which has a little bit meaning for me. Leo versus Virgo. Once upon a time, there were 2 kings, Leo and Virgo. Leo was a born warrior, one who ruled the rulers. Virgo was a perfectionist, one born with a brilliant mind. Being rulers, each one of a kind, they had never crossed each other's paths. Being served by the royal treatment, they had moved around the world as strangers. Leo loved to be applauded by his audience, and Virgo being appreciated in silence. Not aware that he is the lion, one day Virgo met Leo and shook hands with him. Both rulers turned companions and became significant to rule together. But Virgo was ignorant that Leo was a true lion, one who always rules alone. Virgo was the savior of the Vulcan, the god of brilliance. Leo was a winner, mapped to victory and power, but lacked one thing, brilliance. Deceived by the true colors of Leo, the land of Vulcans were attacked one night. Virgo marched with his army to face the attacker and saw it was Leo, the masked companion. An arrow of betrayal hit Virgo as he stood immobile for a moment. As Leo was blindfolded to rule knowledge, Virgo had failed his people. His eyes had so much clarity that Leo could see himself in them. Leo could see that his greed would destroy Virgo and his people. King of wisdom, the Virgo knew he could not fight Leo's army. The lion surrounded the city and demanded for Vulcan. The king of power, Leo, was the only fool in the land of wisdom now. And the warrior of knowledge glared at him in pity. After all, he was born Virgo, and they never make noise. Power versus knowledge. Who won?
The rhythms of the language. Say thank you for being on the show, and I'm really looking forward to getting somebody to critique your work. Bilko, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
And I'm Zoom interviewing you from beautiful Illinois. It's 6 a.m. here and about 3 p.m. in your time. One of the things I really love about having Swaga in the group, really identifying the issues about her sense of English and how it's used.
Also, Marie, just don't forget that some of the greatest contemporary English literature coming out of India. Think of The God of Small Things as just this stunning piece of writing.
Ah, yes, Arundhati Roy. Just tell me a little bit about your dealings with language and the kind of work that you do.
Yeah, one of the bits of work that we're doing lately is looking at the differences between speaking and writing. So I work in the area of literacy. I'm interested also in how digital text is bending what literacy is in all sorts of ways. That's the work that I do.
Almost like a deconstruction of language.
You know, Swaga was saying she's a software developer.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, poetry is more like software development than anything else, where people agonize about a line, they knock out the bugs, and you know, they go back over it, they try it out, they make a little adjustment here and all that kind of stuff. So it's incredibly premeditated. It might take, I don't know, half a day to write half a page of code. Well, yes. It might take half a day or a week or a month to write a piece of poetry. And in a sense, what's interesting about software development and poetry as crafts is they're essentially visual crafts. It's about rearranging stuff in space. This word here, that word there, go back over it, backwards and forwards. So a kind of a multilinear spatial configuration process.
What about this notion of, I don't know, this amazing display of using English as the platform for her creative expression? And she's starting to identify that it is slightly different to the type of English that we use in the Western world.
Look, there's this whole idea now that English is not a single language. The majority of speakers of English in the world are not first language speakers. And the difference between people who use English a lot in the Caribbean or India or wherever are extraordinary. So the differences are actually quite interesting. But Indian English is quite distinctive. It's got all sorts of peculiarities in it. It's a bit like when you listen to some Aboriginal English. It sounds quaint. It's full of old, funny, old-fashioned turns of phrase. It's quite beautiful in a distinctive kind of way. So in a way, it's about distinctive voices. It's a polyphonic language that we speak.
A polyphonic language.
But one of the very interesting things is how incredibly different speech is from writing. And what a strange thing poetry is. Poetry is spoken. It's written around sounds, but in fact, it's unusually premeditated. You know, you think of every word, you work back over it. You know, one of the incredible things about speech is there are no sentences in speech. It's a pile of clauses, just one after the other, rambling on, whatever. Now, the interesting thing about poetry is how it is actually quintessentially a written form. It's more a written form than anything else.
But something that actually makes this come alive as a poem is the imagination that goes through it. What is the impact?
Yes, it came up in her notion of mystery.
Yes.
Or maybe whether her husband would understand that she was writing about him, and maybe she's not going to tell him or whatever. You know, the relationship between the writer and the reader is not one of you getting my feeling, which I'm going to pass over to you by my expressing it clearly and graphically and whatever.
Yeah.
It's actually a relationship of deception. And the mystery is a very good example of this. So a very famous semiotician, a theorist of meaning by the name of Umberto Eco, the name of the rose, and who was also a professor as well as a...
Of course, one of my favourite writers, Umberto Eco, name of the rose. Brilliant.
He said, and in fact, what writing narrative is about, not just mysteries, it's a game of deception, where you make the reader think that some person did the murder, and at the end, shockingly, it's somebody else who did the murder who was in plain sight all along. And what a fool you were for not noticing it, because in retrospect, you should have noticed. And what often holds the reader, they're trying to figure out, how is this author messing with me? So in a way, good authorship is about messing with readers, surprising readers, telling readers they were fools because they didn't notice something.
But you could equally say it's a process of discovery. The epic tales that she grew up with, you deliver the story through a series of surprise packages.
The notion of a spoiler is actually the notion of spoiling the game, right?
Yes,
so
yes.
The game is one where building this artifice. So people think about communication as, you know, I've got a feeling and I want to get it to you. No, it's not that at all. It's actually, I've got a feeling and I want to trick you in order for you to get there yourself later on. Now, I don't know whether religious texts do this or not. I mean, maybe I'm just trying to think of Yeah, I suppose they do. I mean, I suppose every miracle that happens in, or every fantastic thing that happens in a religious text is unexpected. So there's a lesson in the unexpectedness. So it's the narrative as one of these things that human beings do to each other, if you like.
Well, there's the intrigue as well. Why is it that we need to tell each other's stories?
I don't know whether you know much about agile software development. It's now the main methodology that software stories. So the user story is, I'm building a piece of software which books people's tickets to the theatre and prints out the tickets. Right? I can do it online and blah, 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 blah. So a user story is always starts with I, a central character. I want to buy a ticket to the theatre, and I go to the website, and I do this, and I do that. There are narrative structures built into everything we do, and often we conceive structures of event, and I'm buying a ticket because it prefigures me going to the theatre. One of the ways in which we as human beings imagine our futures, plan things out, is in these event structures, which have a setting, which have an action, and have an outcome. So one of the things you might argue is that it's just an intrinsic part of all our lives, kind of a fascinating connection with the work that Swire does. Poetry is essentially a written funny kind of conceit to think that it's oral, and the conceit is the theatricality of reading it. And a poetry reading is a reading, it's not speech. And I think poetry particularly needs to be really carefully read, with as much care as the person who wrote it put into writing. So what I caught was only impressionistic. Yeah, I agree. It was what I heard. It wasn't written to sound nice. It was written.
You would have appreciated it more if you could read it and see the structure of it.
As a matter of fact, one rule I have when we make video lectures in our courses, my rule to myself is only ever do it in chaotic rambling speech. Never read the damn thing, whatever. But it's easy to listen to something that's rambling. That's what we're used to in a regular conversation. That's what we're used to listening to. It's very hard to listen to stuff that's been incredibly carefully fabricated. Or if you do, you better listen to it a whole lot of times.
Yeah. But there are some other pieces that just fall on you, a bit like rain, and you just feel, I don't know, enriched by it without processing it mentally at all. And for me, Swaga's work and the way I see it impact other people in the group, where it's very much just about listening, is that it just creates a lot of pleasure.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming to the interview. And now to our second critiquer, Caroline George, and I'll let her introduce herself.
Thanks, Maria. So I am first generation Australian. My parents are from South India, born and brought up pretty much in Australia, but have been living quite a few years in London and LA. And I'm back now in Sydney due to the pandemic until who knows when.
I take it you're in the acting industry?
I am. Yes. Yeah? I would predominantly say I'm an actor, but as you know, like I'm also doing some voiceover, presenting.
Were your parents brought up with English?
English is not their first language. They speak a dialect called Malayalam, which is actually from Kerala and that state. Like they can speak English fine and, you know, absolutely. But when they switch into that language, you can hear the nuances that are so background.
And there are so many of us in Australia not from an English speaking background.
And did you grow up with Greek then?
Yes.
Yeah. Can you speak Greek fluently?
So badly. But I.
Hello there.
What are your impressions of Swaga's work? I could see both of us look up at each other and sort of gasp.
I mean, I think the interesting thing about it was that it started off in just this really soft and whimsical kind of place. The lilts
the rolling,
and
you're rolling your hand the same way.
Yes. Like, and I was really on that journey. And then at the end, I was like, oh, my God, she's jumped. So I was sort of transported between Paris and Mumbai, and I've been to both of those cities. The biggest word that I had was juxtaposition. As I said, there was this silence of quiet night in Paris. There was turmoil in perhaps her heart and her mind, but then a silence and stillness as well. So there was just all these, as I said, juxtapositions that I felt cold. I felt like I was in
ominousness.
Eerie.
There was an eeriness.
Eeriness, warmth, but that's what I mean. So many.
I kept on using the word amalgam.
But I'm shocked that when she said that it wasn't a suicide. I mean, was she pushed? Absolutely not expecting that. And I did gasp, and both of us were like, oh, did that just happen?
I hear that, I have the same reaction.
Wow. Like, oh, I'm ready to go on this magical, wonderful journey. Oh my God, she's dead.
So that's where her story then starts.
Love it.
It works.
Can't wait to see what's going to happen next.
What's going to happen next?
Tune in next time.
Yeah. Now, Caroline, what about the fish story?
I mean, firstly, I just want to say, for me, frying fish is so important in our culture as well. And that transported me to a beach in Kovalam. Such a passionate experience. Oh my gosh, if you don't eat hot fish, it's rubbery and gross.
It's done.
You just miss it. If you don't get it in that first 10 seconds and with that hit of lemon, it just loses the whole experience. So
And it's such a simple fragment of life, and yet it says so much.
And the love that she was putting into it. Like, I want to show you how much
in your
culinary
mouth.
Mastery as
and
well.
Yet, and yet,
when people say things in such subtle ways that you can grab your own meaning from it rather than being, like you said, told what to think and how to feel. I think that she's done that in such a masterful way.
Yeah.
And masterpiece is true. really took everybody on a journey, even though he has a particular type of voice and an accent. You don't feel alienated from it.
She has a grasp of her own culture and is speaking from within it.
But you get it.
You get it. You're totally in it. What about Virgo and Leo?
I can't believe we ended on this one because I am obsessed with astrology and I am a Virgo. So I love the way she balanced each one of those traits. And as an actor as well, like, you want to be able to tell a story and tell it well and take someone on a journey. I don't know. I feel really refreshed and energized.
Refreshed and energized.
Wow, that's really interesting. Like, when my mum starts frying fish, I'm going to really kind of watch every element of it. But no, it's amazing. And thank you so much for sharing it with me.
And now on to Peter Worthington, who is our chief technical manager here at 2RPH. So, Peter, you have got such a well-trained ear. You're working in radio. You've been a curator of book readings here for at least 10 years. The way things sound is pretty important to you.
Well, I think a particular reading of that poem, the thing that really struck me was the accent. There's a certain music in there that would make her speech sound poetic even if she wasn't reading a poem.
Yes.
But the fact that it is a poem, I think, even adds to the effect.
Yeah, so it's almost like an echo.
There were some interesting terms of phrase that's used, and I thought an English speaker wouldn't say it like that way, but the way it was said sort of made a lot more sense.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
To be able to reconfigure the English language from a different cultural viewpoint and make it, I don't know, kind of resonate.
Probably representative of poetry itself. The fact that it isn't sort of standard conversational English, it adds that little bit of obscurity to the meaning.
And what about the fish story, Peter? I could see you laughing all the way through that.
Yeah, it had a certain humour about it. You know, on the one hand, the guilt, do I have the piece of fish without telling him? And, you know, he can't have it. And then, of course, in the end, it's straight diatribe of...
All the weight was on my face.
Yeah, the long face. Yeah.
It still works.
Oh, yeah. In fact, the imagery was so clear with that. You know, I think because we talk about somebody having a long face, it's almost a cliche, isn't it?
Yes.
But, you know, the weight of the face, you have to think, hang on, that's what it looks like. And it's, you know, in one of these madhouse mirror things where the face is distorted.
Yes.
And your chin's down by your knees somewhere.
That kind of action scene, you know, that puts you right in that place.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think the way it was read helped too. This almost waterfall of words, wasn't it? Yeah. Not so much a waterfall, maybe a river.
So even though it's very different to the poem, there is that same sense of delivery.
It had a structure, and at the end, it's almost intense.
Yes, yes. Yeah. What did you like most about it? Like, you were almost relieved that this wasn't a heavy piece.
I thought it was going to be a discussion of sensuality, the cooking, and then it moved, I won't say dramatically, but quite rapidly into something entirely different.
A little domestic drama.
A little domestic drama, and I thought that was great.
Peter, thank you so much. This is Maria Rosaris, and it was a pleasure to bring you this program, produced in the Sydney studios of 2RPH. I look forward to your company next time.